Well, some months ago, way back in March, actually, my wife and I had the chance to go to California. It was a great gift. I love California. I think in another life, I should have been born in California. Anyway, I'm here with you. And it was amazing. It was just a fantastic trip. We had a wonderful time. But the only minor challenge, the only hiccup, was getting two toddlers to California. It's almost like getting children to church. So I did some research about the flight, you know, like how are we gonna get them there? How's this gonna go? The car seats, all of this. And so I did a quick Google search, which went something like this: flying with children life hack. And I found all kinds of interesting stuff. Some of it was very helpful. I learned about games and rewards for good behavior. Obviously, lots and lots of snacks. One blog simply suggested Benadryl, which we did not try, but I would certainly be open to it. And so we went on this trip and had a wonderful time, and yet I would not say that the flight itself was luxurious, nor was it luxurious for our neighbors in the seats behind us, who got stuff thrown on them the whole flight. Because you see, the truth of the matter is, and you all know this probably, that traveling with children is just innately hard. There's really no way around it. There's no special life hack that makes it easy every single time. There's just no way around it to make it easy. And really, if we think about it, there aren't really life hacks at all, are there? All the things we encounter in life that are challenging or hard, there typically aren't easy ways around those challenges, are there? In fact, I'd even go as far to say that term life hack has a deceptive quality to it that I do not like, because it suggests in this subtle way that we can control the outcome of our circumstances. Fly with a child in a plane one time, you'll surely find out that is not the case. And so whatever your circumstances may be, whatever they will be, whatever they have been, you can do whatever you can to try and change those, but there is no life hack for it. And scripturally speaking, we see this work out all over the Bible. And maybe the most remarkable story of this sort of challenge with circumstances is the story of Jacob. It's an Old Testament reading that we just heard. Maybe you know this story well. It is fantastic. It's worth just reading the whole sprawling narrative at some point. But his whole story, you could say, really the whole life of Jacob is really about him trying to shortcut or to control or to manipulate the circumstances of his life into something that he desires. It's all about him trying to swindle his way out of the circumstances that he have been given. And you see this play out. It begins like this, the story. Jacob, you know this, he is the son of Isaac, who had received that great and incredible promise given to Abraham, one of the greatest promises, covenants in the Bible, that God would transform Abraham's whole family into this immense people, a whole nation, a kingdom that would reflect God's goodwill, his character, his purposes, and his delights to the world. That was the covenant, that he would grow them. So these are, for the son of Isaac, enormous shoes to fill. Think about it. His family is explicitly commissioned by God to become the redeeming presence of God in the whole world. It's a big calling. And that is the inheritance of the son of Isaac. But you see, there's a catch here. There's a catch. Because Jacob, he is not the only son of Isaac. You probably heard this last week. Esau, his brother, is a twin. And Esau was technically born just before Isaac, but barely, which means that technically Esau is the inheritor of the blessing and the calling that was given to Abraham. Furthermore, and this is a really hard part, Esau is his father's favorite son. And they both know it. Esau is the favorite. Esau, it seems his interests, they are perfectly orchestrated to receive the favor and the blessing and the delight of the Father. And Jacob is forgotten. Maybe you've felt this way before. Maybe your family looks a little like that. I don't know. One of the best stories of this sort of occurrence, ironically, it's the story of Martin Luther. Maybe you know this story as well. Luther is probably the most influential, but he is one of the most influential human beings in all of Western history. Of course, you know this. He's one of the primary instigators of the Protestant Reformation. And one of the preeminent questions that Luther had again and again and again was, how are human beings justified or made righteous before God? That is it possible for a human being to justify themselves by their own work and therefore please God? He was absolutely obsessed with this question, can we make ourselves righteous? Now, if you go back and you read the various biographies of Luther, which there are many, and they're all pretty fun, to be honest. He's a really interesting character. You should check them out. Some of them take this kind of this psychoanalytic approach to his life, which generally, personally, I'm not a fan of. But in Luther's case, it's fascinating. It's fascinating because Luther's dad, his name was Hans, Luther's dad was kind of the first modern self-made man. Luther's father grew up as a peasant. He was a smelter, which meant that he worked in mines. He did peasant's work. He did dirty work. But by his own effort and skill and persistence, he gained a standing. Eventually, he accumulated aspects of the company, and he oversaw portions of it. He had people who served him. And in doing that, he was one of the first people to move from one class to the next. This did not happen in the medieval world. If you were a peasant, you stayed a peasant, but not for Hans Luther. And so you can understand that when Hans had a child, Martin, his great, great hope was that he would never have to do the work that he did. And so Hans longed for his son to pursue a career in law. He was clear about that with him from a very early age. But you know the story, that's not what happened. Martin not only did not become a lawyer, he became a priest. And his dad hated it, absolutely hated it. And some biographers will say that underneath all of Luther's greatness, all of his passion and his competence and his skill, was simply this one desire to please his dissatisfied father, to make him happy. And so with that story in mind, I wonder, with Jacob, the son who cannot please his father, if that is what's happening in his heart the whole of his life, again and again and again, how do I please my father? How do I please my dad? And it is, in fact, if you look at his whole story, it's what he does. All the details, they bear out this evidence. Everything that Jacob does is this effort to supplant his brother Esau. And in fact, if you look back, his name means supplanter, swindler. He's a trickster. And so we see in the story that we had last week that Jacob steals his brother's birthright. Then he steals his brother's inheritance. And then he steals the brother's blessing of the father, given to the firstborn, meant to carry the promise of Abraham to the next generation, and he swindles his brother Esau out of everything. And then he does what any good swindler would do. He runs. And he runs to the house of his uncle Laban, who is his mother's brother. But on this journey, he does not get there before nightfall. And so he ends up sleeping in the middle of nowhere. The term there, the place, is no place. He's in the middle of nowhere with his head on a rock, being hated by his brother, and nobody's there to help him. Now, I just want you to take stock of this image for a moment. Jacob has tried to control and manipulate all of the circumstances of his life in order to get what he wants, but then look at where this leads. Again, he is completely alone. He is in the middle of the desert. He is the lesser favored son. He has nothing except a rock underneath his head. And all of this misfortune, all of it is his fault. Everything is his fault. You might say, sure, Esau is the one who is the favored son. But Jacob is the one who thieves his way out of all of it. And he ends up alone in the desert with a rock for a pillow. So he goes to sleep in our story, and when he falls asleep, there is this mysterious and completely unexpected act of grace. This will become common for him, but there is this moment of great redemption that is almost unfathomable. He goes to sleep, he has a dream, and in that dream he wakes up and he sees heaven opened up in front of him. And not only that, but there is a ladder that descends from heaven. Angels are ascending and descending. There's commerce between this world and the next one. And then there at the top, the hole into heaven, into life and blessing, is God himself. And he even speaks to Jacob. He says, I am the God of your father and grandfather. And now the promise that I gave to them, I now give to you. He says, your family, they will be like dust that covers the earth. You'll cover the whole globe. He says, I'll give you land, I'll give you a place, and this is even more incredible. He says, I will not leave you until what I've done, what I've promised is finished. He says, I won't leave you. And I think anybody who has some sense of narrative here, anybody who's read a novel, whoever's read a novel, most of you probably, you would wonder, what in the world is happening? Why does Jacob get such an extravagant promise? How could he receive a gift so generous when everything he has done has been crooked and twisted and self-oriented? And it's because of this, friends, it's very simple. The God of Jacob is extravagantly, excessively, exceedingly, he is exceedingly faithful. He is faithful to the very bitter end. Even when we are not. And in fact, if you read through all of the scriptures, you'll notice that the Israelites often remember God in a very specific way. They call God the God of Jacob. So if you read through the Psalms, you see this everywhere. The psalmist will cry out in worship or in request or petition or in pain, and he will call God the God of Jacob. And I think that's fascinating because you notice it's not the God of Daniel. It's not the God of Elijah. It's not even the God of Moses. They plead to the God of Jacob. And you wonder why. I think it's because when you see the God of Jacob, you actually see who God really is. When you see the God of Jacob through the eyes of Jacob, you actually see who God really is. Think about it. We all tend to think of God being faithful when we are devoted or obedient or good or wise, or we even, at the very least, think about God being faithful in our distress. So when suffering hits us or we experience tragedy or loss, something unjust or unfair, we think of God being faithful. But in the story of Jacob, what about God being faithful when all of the suffering, all that afflicts us, is our fault? What about God being faithful when we lie or when we cheat or when we say wicked things to people that we love? What about God being faithful when we manipulate our circumstances at the cost of others? What about God being faithful when we've done nothing for him? But you see, friends, that is the God of Jacob. And the God of Jacob is infinitely faithful. The God of Jacob is faithful when we do what God says. The God of Jacob is faithful when we don't do what God says. And the God of Jacob is faithful even when all the suffering we experience could be our own fault. He says, I will never leave you until what I promise comes complete. And you see, that is the God of the gospel as well, isn't it? The God of Jacob is none other than the God of Jesus Christ, the God of the good news given to us in his Son, because what we see in the person and work of Jesus Christ is that it can be all of your fault. Everything you hate about your circumstances, you can have done it all to yourself. And heaven is opened up. And the ladder descends. There's commerce between this world and that one. And his will is made perfect in you. But there's one final thing here, if you're paying attention to the readings. How could this detail that I've just given to you be true? How could any of that be true if we just read that gospel reading that we just read? Did any of y'all catch that? The gospel reading wasn't a very friendly, or it wasn't it doesn't boost your self-esteem necessarily. How could all of the goodness of God's mercies given in Jacob be true if we read something about how there is an end of all things? How can God's grace be real, in other words, when Jesus says there are weeds and there are wheat all together planted in the kingdom, and the plants that produce fruit will be welcomed as sons of righteousness, and the weeds that produce nothing are cast into fire? You know, it baffles me. This reading, it is not unclear. It is in no way unclear. It's one of the few parables, in fact, that Jesus explains. He tells them what it's about. But how could that God be that God? Just look again back to Jacob. Notice what Jacob does, friends, immediately after he receives this dream. Do you see what he does? He wakes up, he anoints the rock, and then he carries on. He wakes up, he anoints the rock, and then he carries on. You might say, well, how on earth is that bearing fruit? But just think about how all of this eventually works out. It is truly incredible. Think about the details. Jacob will go on to have 12 sons. These 12 sons then become the leaders of the 12 tribes of Israel. These 12 tribes of Israel then go on to produce, eventually, Jesus Christ, the Messiah, who teaches and instructs and is the master of 12 apostles who bear out the gospel of the kingdom of God to all corners of the earth, to you and to me. So again, does Jacob bear fruit? I'd say yes. How does it begin? He anoints the rock. If you read back, and I'll end on this, if you read back at ancient commentary, I don't like reading people who are alive typically. If you're alive and writing on the Bible, I'm probably not going to read you. I like the dead people. And if you read back at all of the very old dead people writing in the early church, they read this story and they see Jacob anoint this rock, and we think, gosh, what a lousy choice for a pillow. You know what they think? That's Jesus Christ. It must be Jesus Christ. You know what Christ is? Messiah, the anointed one. He anoints the rock. Where else? Jesus is called all through the Gospels, the rock. It has to be him. What does Jesus do? He opens heaven to us. It must be him. And before you say, that sounds ridiculous, there's no way that detail in the story is about the rock, just think about what that might mean for you. Think about what that means. It means that the worst circumstances in your life, where you lay your head down on a rock for a pillow, all of a sudden, they yield the promise of God given to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, Elijah, and you. Again, you see the great hope in that, don't you? It means whatever circumstances you want to life hack your way out of, whatever circumstances afflict you and you hate and despise, friends, if you lay your head down on the rock who is Jesus Christ, his faithfulness, it will find you. You'll see it in every turn. And then, fruit, according to his mercy. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.